Oh, well, thank you very much, Diane, for that kind introduction, and thanks to AFIA for hosting this and for the opportunity to discuss small business finance with you today. I promise to try to keep the acronyms to a minimum. I guess the main one is SMEs, or small and medium-sized enterprises, so that'll come up now and again. So small businesses play a critical role in the Australian economy. They employ nearly 5 million Australians. They account for about one-third of private non-financial output, and they're a key source of innovation and competition. Many small businesses use external finance from banks as well as other sources to manage their cash flows, invest in new equipment, and expand their operations. The Reserve Bank's been paying close attention to small businesses' access to finance for many years. Every year for almost three decades, we've convened a panel of small businesses to better understand the issues that they face. We also speak with businesses, banks, and other financiers through our various liaison programs. A consistent and ongoing theme is that smaller businesses find it a challenge to access finance. But today I'm going to discuss how smaller businesses have been affected by the economic downturn over the past year, and with a particular focus on their access to finance. I'll also outline the measures that were introduced to help mitigate the additional financing difficulties that small businesses faced as a result of the pandemic. So just by way of background, while economic conditions are improving now, it's been a particularly tough year for small businesses. The pandemic caused the largest economic downturn in Australia since the 1930s. Businesses in all industries and of all sizes have been significantly affected, although the experience has been quite even. If we just go to my first chart now. In particular, as you can see here, small businesses have generally been hit a bit harder than larger businesses. Many businesses surveyed by the ABS reported that revenue in June of last year was much lower than the year prior. But small businesses were about twice as likely as large businesses to have reported declines of 50% or more. And this difference, as you can see here, was apparent in retail sales data. Much of the difference between small and large businesses reflects the fact that many small businesses operate in industries such as cafes, restaurants, arts and recreation, and those were the industries that were most affected by COVID-19 restrictions. We go to my next chart now. Thanks. So when it comes to finance, the past year has actually been not so volatile for small businesses in general. Aggregate lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, that's been little changed since the onset of the pandemic. Indeed, SME lending has been around its current level for the past few years. And my next slide. Aside from lending to the agricultural sector, which has increased through much of 2020, lending has been flat for SMEs really across the board. But lending to SMEs in those industries most adversely affected by the pandemic has been low for some time. So you can see those on the left-hand side of this chart. In contrast to SMEs, lending to large businesses, that had increased sharply in March and April of last year. And that's because those businesses were drawing upon sizable lines of credit at that time. And they've since repaid those funds, though outstanding lending remains for large businesses is a little bit above where it was pre-pandemic. There's been little change in total SME lending over the past 12 months for several reasons. In part, it reflects the reluctance of some businesses to take on more debt in a weaker and more uncertain economic environment. At the same time, many businesses, including smaller ones, have been able to make use of government and private sector measures designed to support business cash flows. And that's reduced the need for many businesses to access external finance, which is more expensive, of course, than a business's own internal funds. Another factor weighing on lending is a more cautious approach by banks in deciding whether to finance small businesses. Much of that has just reflected the application of pre-existing lending standards of the banks in a weaker economic environment. But lending standards have also been tightened. For example, banks have required a greater degree of verification of a borrower's information. Banks have been more cautious about lending to new business customers and particularly to sectors hit hardest by the pandemic. But many of the challenges small businesses face when accessing finance have been around for many years. Although I'm focusing on the experience in Australia right now, it's worth noting that these challenges are certainly not unique to small and medium-sized enterprises in Australia. We go to my next chart. Small businesses, particularly less established ones, they tend to be riskier than large established firms with a track record of profitability. As a result, lenders reject a greater proportion of loan applications from smaller businesses. They also charge more to take on the additional risk associated with the loans that they provide. And the terms for the loans may also be more restrictive. For instance, loans to small businesses may often be quite small relative to the size of that business or require collateral or personal guarantees. Indeed, as you can see here, around 95% of loans to SMEs are secured, and that compares with around 70% for large business loans. And about half of the small business loans are secured by residential property. Now, many small business owners may not be well placed to provide sufficient home equity to secure a suitable loan. If we move to my next chart. Thank you. So small businesses generally have few viable alternatives for external finance outside of traditional intermediated finance. Unlike large businesses, it's too costly for them to raise funds directly from capital markets. Now, Australian small businesses have made increasing use of non-traditional sources of finance in recent years, such as balance sheet lending and marketplace lending, as illustrated here. However, the available data suggests that non-traditional sources of finance accounted for less than 2% of overall SME lending in 2018. So it was expected that the difficulties that I've just talked about that smaller businesses face in accessing finance would worsen during the pandemic. And so a range of policies were put in place to support the provision of low-cost finance to small businesses. The Reserve Bank introduced a package of monetary policy measures at the onset of the pandemic, and these have helped to reduce the costs of finance to historically low levels and have been supporting the supply of credit to businesses and strengthening household and business balance sheets. If we go to my next chart, the term funding facility provides low-cost term funding to banks. It includes incentives for banks to increase their lending to non-financial businesses, especially SMEs. So for every dollar of extra lending to SMEs, a bank is allocated a further $5 of low-cost funds from the TFF. And a range of banks have managed to expand their lending to SMEs, and they've benefited, therefore, from these additional allowances under the TFF, which are shown here in green. The government also introduced a range of significant measures to support business cash flows and balance sheets, policies such as JobKeeper, boosting cash flow for employers, enhanced tax incentives for investment. All of those have reduced the costs for businesses. They've also helped to increase household disposable income and supported aggregate demand more broadly. So those policies have preserved employment relationships between firms and employees. They've helped otherwise viable businesses stay afloat when their revenues were markedly reduced by COVID-19 restrictions. These measures reduce the need for many businesses to borrow, and that accords with ABS surveys conducted in both October last year and then updated again in February of this year, in which most businesses indicated that they had sufficient funds and did not need additional finance. Similarly, late last year, non-financial companies had built up cash buffers that could cover nearly 6 months' worth of expenses, which is an increase of around 30% compared with prior to the pandemic, and at the same time, unincorporated businesses had increased their cash buffers by a little less, by 20%, to a bit over 2 months' worth. So other measures associated with the pandemic have been introduced to support the supply of credit. That includes the Australian government's $15 billion structured support fund to help smaller lenders access funding. There's also the $40 billion SME loan guarantee scheme to enable participating lenders to issue cheaper loans to small business. That loan guarantee system scheme has just been enhanced for SMEs that have been receiving JobKeeper. those SMEs can borrow up to 5 million for up to 10 years, and that compares to 1 million and 5 years previously under the earlier version of this scheme. The funds can also be used for refinancing of some existing loans, and in addition, the government is guaranteeing up 80% of each loan under the expanded scheme, and that's up from 50%. Support's also being provided by the private sector. Landlords allowed for more flexible rent arrangements, and banks offered to defer loan payments. So along with the country's success on their health front, those policies have lessened the economic impact of the pandemic and underpinned the recovery that's now well underway. The effects of this have started to flow through to small businesses overall. Measures of small business confidence have increased over the past 6 months. In February, a smaller share of businesses indicated that economic uncertainty was weighing on their investment plans than had been the case in August of last year. Labour market outcomes have also improved, and the increase in job openings and employment growth observed since late last year have been particularly pronounced in industries that were most affected by those COVID-19 restrictions. Again, these are the industries that are most heavily populated by smaller businesses. And finally, there are a number of ongoing government initiatives that will continue to support small businesses after the temporary measures associated with the pandemic are phased out. These were developed prior to the pandemic in response to these long-running concerns about access to finance by SMEs that I talked about earlier. So one such initiative is the $2 billion Australian Business Securitisation Fund that invests in securitisations that are backed by loans to SMEs issued by small banks and non-bank lenders. Another initiative is the Australian Business Growth Fund. This will provide longer-term equity funding to established SMEs looking to expand. It's jointly backed by the Australian government and a number of banks, and it was launched with $540 million in the first instance to invest in SMEs. And then finally on this front, the Australian government's also recently reformed insolvency laws for small business, introduced a new scheme for monitoring how quickly large businesses pay their invoices. And both of those things aim to improve the environment for small business. So now I want to ask about how effective those policy measures have been at supporting credit. It's been roughly a year from the onset of the pandemic, and so quite a useful time to reflect on the effectiveness of all of those policies. If we move to my next chart. So the supply of finance still remains tighter than before the pandemic, particularly for those businesses that were hit the hardest. While there are signs that conditions have started to improve a little recently, surveys of small businesses indicate that access to finance remains difficult, as you can see here on the right-hand side. Even so, policy responses have helped to cushion the impact of the tighter access to credit. The cash rate cuts through 2020 pushed by the Reserve Bank, other initiatives to reduce banks' funding costs, such as the TFF, they've flowed through to lower interest rates on SME loans. So outstanding rates on variable loans to SMEs on average have declined by about 85 basis points since February last year. And by our estimates, that's a little more than the corresponding decline in bank funding costs. And interest rates on loans are still drifting lower at the moment. The Reserve Bank's TFF provided a strong incentive for banks to increase their overall lending to SMEs. And a range of banks have been able to take advantage of that, which I showed you earlier. The Australian government's loan guarantee scheme, that's put some downward pressure on SME interest rates. So some of the SMEs that have managed to borrow through that unsecured in that scheme have done so at rates that are comparable to those for secured loans outside of the scheme. We move to my next chart. This shows that although the spread between rates on SME loans and large businesses has increased over the past year, that's in the bottom panel, the increase has been really fairly slight. And in particular, that increase is considerably smaller than that which occurred at the time of the GFC, although the spread had never returned to those pre-GFC levels. Of course, I should emphasise that pricing alone doesn't really provide a complete picture of the availability of finance. Indeed, small businesses have reported that the price has not been the biggest impediment to accessing finance over the past few years. For instance, entrepreneurs in our small business panels, they note that access to finance for startups is a challenge. Banks often have substantial collateral requirements, and the process of getting finance is quite lengthy and onerous. We move to my next chart. So over 200,000 SME borrowers arranged to defer their loan payments last year. And what this chart shows you is that the vast majority have now resumed making payments on those loans. So the share of SME loans with a deferral peaked at around 13%, as shown here in June of last year, and it's now around 1%. We move to the next slide. So consistent with these outcomes, the modelling, which is shown here from large banks, suggests the risk of default for small businesses relative to large businesses didn't change much in 2020. Nevertheless, business failures are expected to rise as some of the pandemic support measures are phased out. SME lending overall has been little changed over the past year, in part reflecting, as I suggested before, the effectiveness of the various measures in supporting businesses' cash flows. However, there have been pockets of increased financing activity. In the second half of 2020, commitments for new SME loans increased to a little to around the level seen in the lead up to the pandemic. And much of that increase owes to business borrowing for the purposes of property and plant and equipment purchases. And the latter is consistent with the expansion of the Australian government's instant asset tax write-off scheme. Then we move to my last chart. This shows that refinancing by SMEs has been higher over the financial year to date compared with the same period a year earlier. And that's consistent with businesses seeking to obtain a better deal with lower interest rates on offer. So the orange line in the bottom panel is a bit above the line shown for 2019-20. So let me just wrap things up with a brief conclusion now. Overall, smaller businesses have suffered significantly from the economic hardship caused by the pandemic. A wide range of monetary, fiscal, and indeed private sector measures have provided support. Indeed, many of those measures obviated the need for small businesses to take out additional debt over the past year. While businesses' confidence has improved markedly of late, a number of businesses, particularly smaller businesses, they remain reluctant to take out new loans. And some of this reflects an economic outlook that, while improved, is still a very uncertain one. Also, access to finance for smaller businesses has been a long-standing challenge. Now, there are a range of policies in place to help support the supply of business credit as the economic recovery proceeds. Given the importance of small businesses to the economy, the Reserve Bank will continue to pay close attention to their access to finance and their prospects more broadly. So thank you, Diane. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I look forward to your questions. And I think I stuck to the promise of fairly minimal acronyms there.
Yeah, you may have under-delivered on the acronyms, but you've certainly over-delivered on the data and the charts. So thanks, Chris. Look, before I go to questions from AFIA members and the media, I do have a few of my own. For those of you who know me, that's not surprising. Look, I just want to go a little bit deeper into some of the things that you've just gone through and also just draw on a chart that actually the governor used in a speech last week. So one of the charts you had was that SME retail sales were down, and they're coming back, but they were down. Lending is flat in the SME space, and conditions for lending may be tighter. But the chart that the governor referred to last week also showed that investment by SMEs is probably overweight for their sector versus, say, larger companies. So is it fair to say that SMEs are actually punching above their weight and lifting this recovery more than perhaps other parts of the economy? And if we want a real business-led recovery, do we really need to be incentivizing larger companies to start to do more of the heavy lifting?
Well, yeah, I think the way I like to think about that comparison in terms of small businesses, if you like, investing disproportionate to, say, their share of output compared to larger businesses is is not so, is partly related to the nature of some of those small businesses and comes back to a point I made at the beginning of my speech, that they really are, small businesses can be quite a force for innovation and competition. And of course, what there's many of them are trying, not all of them, but many of them are trying to become larger businesses. And so they do so by investing in new technologies and adopting new technologies. And I think that's, there's quite a lot of dynamism in that sector, quite a lot of entrepreneurs that are making their mark and want to do more. And so it, in some ways, it's really natural to think of them as being doing so much investment compared to their output. That's not true of every small business, but many of them. So I wouldn't describe it so much as sort of large businesses not pulling their weight or small businesses doing more than their fair share. It's more about that's just the nature of many of the small businesses. They're very dynamic and competitive. So what do we need to do? Well, we need to, as a central bank, as policymakers, ensure that we can do what we can to support aggregate demand, because more aggregate demand will in time mean that businesses have an incentive and a desire to invest more, and then for governments, both federal and state, to do what they can to make the environment as conducive as possible to investment.
You also mentioned, Chris, cash buffers, that businesses have got some good cash buffers, and we've heard that households do as well. Are we saving too much and not spending enough at the moment?
No, it makes a lot of sense that both businesses and households did that, in part because there were very limited opportunities to spend for households for a good bunch of last year. The most obvious one is none of us can travel overseas, for example. So there's spending that we just can't do. That's a very obvious one. So it would be natural for savings to go up. It's also the case that savings, both of households and businesses, probably go up at a time of considerable uncertainty. At the moment, what we've seen in the last sort of little while is that those saving rates are coming down. So it's not that they're dis-savings or with making their pool of savings smaller and spending them. They're just adding to them less than they had been before. So that's a good thing in terms of that means more consumption growth. Particularly as household incomes continue to pick up through employment growth in the period ahead. But it stands them in good stead if they need to draw upon their savings, particularly individual households that might be vulnerable to a loss of employment for a time. And then for business, that stands them also in good stead to invest when they're willing and able to do that and when they see the economic environment looking more positive for them.
We've had a question come through, which is I'm going to sort of wrap up into one of my questions, which is SMEG to SMERL. So the SME guarantee scheme has now been called SMERL for your benefit, Chris, in terms of its latest version. That scheme is intended to support, as you said, those who were receiving JobKeeper previously. The risk exposure is shifting in terms of it being a 50-50 risk exposure to 80-20. And it is also now reopened to unsecured lending. So a little bit of a combination of SMEG 1 and SMEG 2 into this latest version. Banks and lenders, particularly banks, are reluctant to lend to SMEs without security. I mean, do you think this scheme's going to help open up greater unsecured lending to SMEs? Or what other hurdles do we need to get rid of?
Well, I think it creates an environment and provides incentive for banks to be more willing to lend, particularly the government increasing the guarantee, the amount that they're guaranteeing. So that reduces considerably the risk for banks, reduces their need to ask the smaller businesses to provide large licks of collateral. So that's a very positive aspect. I think that's going to help the supply of credit, one imagines. The thing we have to remember is what about the demand for credit? And I think that might still take a bit of time. Now, part of it's because of what we just talked about, the significant cash buffers, but also just businesses waiting until they see a strong pickup in aggregate demand and a need to invest. Businesses are more optimistic, their confidence has picked up, and they are employing people. Employment's really bounced back quite a bit.
So picking up on that comment just then, Chris, and sort of shifting into the TFF, it is about the anniversary of the announcement of that facility, as well as the AOFM's program to support smaller lenders, which I believe was on the 19th of March, if my memory serves me correctly. So this Friday is the anniversary for both those initiatives. They have both done incredible work to help normalise markets at the time they were announced. And as you've said, they've helped keep rates down throughout the crisis. The TFF has got some capacity in it that's not being drawn down on. And as you said, there's incentives to lend to small business built into that initiative. Are there, you know, more carrots and sticks that are needed to get some lending going through that facility?
No, I mean, I talked about this in the lead up to and around the time of the initial deadline for the initial allotment of funds under the TFF. And at that time, there was still a gap and funds remaining to be drawn upon. And our expectation would be that most of those would be drawn upon, and then they were. The banks, because they've got plentiful funding from a whole range of sources, aren't in a hurry to lock in that term funding because it's available for 3 years. So our expectation is much the same pattern will repeat. Closer to the deadline, an increasing share will draw upon those funds. They'll lock in that very low rate for 3 years and then be able to take advantage of that cheap source of funding. So that's our expectation and remains the case.
So a number of AFIA members have been letting me know about the appetite that they're seeing from customers, and I think you've touched on it as well as the demand side of things. While the crisis continues to, you know, evolve in Australia, we must be thankful for the position we're in terms of our financial stability and markets positions. But it's right for businesses to feel uncertain and to perhaps be wary about taking on more debt. You know, what are you thinking about at the bank, and what's the, you know, the bank's role in terms of the Council of Financial Regulators? How do we get it right between encouraging, you know, access to credit and ensuring lending standards are maintained?
Well, I think what we've been saying on the small business front particularly is that not that lending standards have been too tight, but that small businesses really lack access to funding. And again, this is not unique to Australia. This is quite a concern globally. And so there have been some of those programs put in place at the margin to try and catalyse a bit more lending, including the Australian Business Growth Fund, for example. So the other thing that ASIC has been doing is just reminding the banks that when it comes to lending to a business, and a small business in particular, the banks may have been quite wary, how do I treat this entity? Is it a business or a household? And when it's treated as a household, the banks might be much more rigorous than they would be if it was a business in terms of looking for a huge amount of detailed information that they wouldn't necessarily look for if they were just treating it as a business loan. And ASIC has been saying for quite some time now, even under the existing responsible lending laws, those need not be applied to small businesses in the way they were should have been applied to households. So I think that if we can sort of make it clear to banks that, you know, they should be treating small businesses differently in a different frame of mind to households, then that would be ultimately a good thing. Saying that might be easier, though, than actually achieving it. So I think it's just something we'll just have to continue to monitor closely over a period of time and continue to sort of remind everybody that, you know, small businesses are really important.
Yeah, and I think AFIA members are very much keen to see how things progress in terms of the, you know, the debate around legislation, but also making sure that law, regulation, and data and technology can find the sweet spot in terms of making sure the process is as simple as possible for borrowers and for lenders as well. A question about the instant asset write-off. Recently, I did a podcast with Alan Oster from NAB, and we were talking about the importance of private investment and business investment in the recovery, and that that needed to continue to be brought forward. A number of AFIA members have indicated that the instant asset write-off is working, but it does feel that perhaps at aggregate it could do a bit more. And it hasn't had a real, sort of impact on CapEx yet. What are your thoughts about the instant asset write-off and should we be doing more in that space?
Look, I couldn't really comment on policy in such a specific way. I mean, the broader point to make about business investment, I think, is that it's usually the case that when you've had a shortfall of aggregate demand, when, as you said, savings of households have picked up significantly, consumption was hit, businesses pull their heads in on investment in very uncertain times, it's normally the case that business investment takes a while to pick up. So first we need to have households become a bit more confident to spend when they see conditions improving. That's happening. Then we need to see businesses responding also by increasing employment. That's happening, and it's partly just an easing of restrictions in this recent case, but more generally that's the sort of nature of recoveries. And then it's only when you've sort of soaked up that spare capacity and employment continues to grow that businesses then feel the need and have the confidence to go and invest. So I think that's in prospect, that's in our forecast, but it's natural that this is exactly the sort of point in a recovery where people are sort of nervous about that. But that's why we are going to continue to provide very substantial monetary support for quite some time to help ensure the recovery is a sufficient one.
You mentioned productivity. Now the governor has mentioned, transport infrastructure as potentially being a limiter to productivity. What is the bank's thinking in terms of the changes to work patterns and whether that could have an influence on the productivity, innovation, employment dynamics?
Well, it's not my area of expertise in the bank, so I won't opine too much on this. I mean, I think the point that we've long been making is you really want an environment where is conducive to business investment for all the reasons I've just stated, because that's stronger business investment is good for both productivity and hence real wage growth over the longer term. It's good for all of our well-being, and good private business investment's helpful there. Investment in the appropriate and broad range of infrastructure is important, but also investment in the way we do things, whether it's sort of the competitive environment, one that rewards people who take risks and try new things and innovate. So, I don't think there's a magic bullet and, you can overdo any one particular thing, but there's a whole range of things we can be doing, and infrastructure spending is just one of them. But infrastructure spending can take many different forms, not always just in the form of construction.
Yeah. Different question. I want to take you back to your slides. You talked about non-traditional lending making up only about 2% in 2018. It'll be interesting to see what the shift is in 19 and 20 and into 21. That 2% level is significantly lower than other markets, so say the US or UK and Europe. I mean, what can we do to increase the supply of non-traditional products into the SME market, which, as we know, if they're concerned about taking on debt, then some of these more, balance sheet cash flow, unsecured products are going to be able to satisfy SMEs who are really wanting to sort of minimize their risks by matching their liabilities and run their business as efficiently. How can we incentivize more activity in that specialized lending space?
I think the one thing we often hear from our small business panelists is that sometimes those forms of finance can be quite suited to them because they can provide different alternative forms of financiers with a history of their business, their revenue streams, their profitability and so on, and their sales. And then, those more innovative lenders can sort of turn around quickly and provide finance, in a fairly efficient way in many cases. But often the complaint is, but it's still often a fairly small amount of finance, possibly for short terms and often still quite expensive. So it does have a role to play and it would be good to see more growth so long as that sort of lending's always done prudently. But at the moment, a lot of our small panelists say it suits their needs in some ways, but not in others, and price is a key one often.
I have a wonk question from one of our members now, which is a question about how does the bank go about forecasting the SME sector's contribution to the economy?
We don't specifically do detailed forecasts of the economy by breaking things down into either regions or industries or large and small businesses. We still a lot of the time rely on forecasts at a fairly macro level. But what we often do is get a better understanding of how macro economy is currently traveling by having a deep look at all of those different sectors and industries, large versus small businesses. And that's why we have a very vigorous liaison program. So I talked about sort of our annual small business panel, but every month the bank gets out through its liaison program to talk to a large number of businesses, large and small, and business associations to try and better understand the economy and the mechanics. And a lot of the time what you're doing there is saying, what's happening now? What are some of the things that are sort of driving the outcomes we're seeing at a macro level? And does that help us better forecast things? Does it say this time round things might be a bit different? And if ever there's been a time where that's really valuable, it's a once in a 100-year pandemic where things can be quite different from the past and the macroeconomic models might not do everything for you that you would like. So that's really how I think about drilling down into industries, sectors, regions, small and large businesses.
So take that a little bit further, Chris. In terms of the bank's regional liaison program, I mean, what's below the macro story that we're hearing? Are you able to share with us a little bit about what SMEs are thinking, feeling and experiencing across Australia at the moment?
Well, it's fairly consistent with some of the survey measures I talked about in that there has been an improvement in confidence, and a lot of that reflects the very positive health outcomes. There are, of course, some industries that are a long way from anything like a recovery. Anything related to international tourism, for example, is still off in the distance. But there are other industries which have bounced back faster than perhaps we expected and even they expected. And that's a very positive thing. So Australia's sort of doing well on so many fronts, but there's still a really long way to go. And I think the sorts of messages in my speech have really been sort of informed by a lot of that business liaison. And that is things are better. There's still quite a bit of uncertainty. And meanwhile, until we get a stronger and more enduring recovery, then the economy is going to need considerable support, and monetary policy is providing that support. And we've been very explicit that we think monetary policy will remain very stimulatory for quite some time.
So I've had a few questions about inflation and interest rates and monetary policy, so I'm going to switch to that now. So we do have ultra-low interest rates, deliberately so, to encourage a search for yield. But if that has an impact on sparking activity in certain asset markets, will the bank consider pulling back the stimulus quicker than expected?
I think we've addressed this in a number of different forums. My high-level summary is that we don't think monetary policy can or should try to control asset prices. Obviously, we're very aware and focused on what asset prices are doing. That's in part because a rise in asset prices is an important and critical part of the transmission mechanism for monetary policy, and it helps people's balance sheets. But the bank's goals are focused very much on supporting employment growth. That in turn will lead to lower unemployment, tighter labour markets, and that will support wage growth, which we need, a pickup in wage growth in order to get inflation back and consistent with the bank's inflation target of 2-3%. So the bank, along with other members of the Council of Financial Regulators, they consider and will continue to consider possible responses if lending standards were to deteriorate. So that's really the critical thing, the focus. If asset prices are rising on the back of deteriorating lending standards and a rise in financial risk, that would be of concern to the council members. And so they could consider a number of different responses. We're not at that point currently, but those responses would not be, first and foremost from monetary policy. In fact, I think there are a lot of other avenues that they would pursue before thinking about stepping back from monetary policy. We've been very clear. The cash rate target for the bank is a really critical instrument, and we've said that that will not be increased until inflation is sustainably in that 2-3% range. So that's got nothing to do, that says nothing about asset prices.
So to take that a little bit further, Chris, we've seen a number of commentators talking about inflation and the views of central banks around the world, that it used to be a bit more predictable about what banks thought around the inflation side of things. We've also seen the IMF speculating about whether negative interest rates are useful. What are your views about all of this speculation in terms of, as a markets practitioner and as an economist, what are you thinking about internationally and domestically when you're providing advice through to the governor on these matters?
Well, I think there's quite a bit of common ground here in the central banking community globally. And what it reflects is something we've talked about before, which is we're all at or very close to the effective lower bound. I'll come back to negative rates in a minute, but we are at the effective lower bound with our policy rate. And so that's a world in which a rise in inflation expectations is a helpful thing, and that's what we've seen in markets in the last few months. So that's fundamentally a good news story, that markets can see a stronger recovery ahead. They're more optimistic about getting a bit of inflation, not runaway inflation by any means, just inflation that's more consistent with central bank targets. So that's essentially a good news story. But what central banks are saying is when you have been stuck at the effective lower bound, a useful part of policy is to say, well, rather than preemptively tighten, let's wait until we see inflation actually consistent with our targets. And that's what we've said. And not just the very first time it pops up there in headline terms, but to be consistent with the targets on a sustainable basis. In terms of negative rates, we've stated quite clearly it's not under consideration here. We don't think it would be a particularly helpful thing to do in Australia, including because banks' willingness to lend might be impinged by negative rates. I just finally note elsewhere in reference to that IMF study, which references quite a bit of academic literature, but if we look elsewhere where negative rates had been used, including prior to the pandemic, those central banks that had adopted negative rates didn't become more negative or move rates down further into negative rate territory during the pandemic. So it sort of suggests that maybe they've reached their limits or they think it would be unhelpful to do more of it.
That's an interesting observation, Chris, about the timing of certain policy settings. Another question on the potential for implications for assets, so housing market and equity markets. I mean, if we are to see, an attempt in terms of slowing inflation, if these areas get a little too hot, I mean, the Reserve has indicated that you'll be purchasing bonds, in terms of keeping yields down, so 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds even. Is that what we should be expecting to see more of?
No, well, we haven't been purchasing bonds that far up the curve. We're sort of stopping around that 10-year basket, more or less. But we've put in place a bond purchase program with not quite finished with that first phase, and we've announced the second phase that will kick on for an additional $100 billion from April through to September, and that the board later this year would consider the case for whether to do more. And that's going to depend very much on economic and financial conditions at the time, as well as probably what other central banks are doing, because a valuable part of what we've done through that program is help to push the Australian dollar lower than it otherwise would have been.
So should we expect that the bank will hold their bonds to maturity?
Well, that's some way off for many of the bonds. I really don't think that's something we need to get into and make decisions about right now, or and certainly not telegraph them publicly. The main point is we're still increasing our holdings at a reasonably good clip of 100 billion over about 6 months period. The first one, as I said, will finish in April. Another 100 billion in September. So that's the thing I'd focus attention on.
I think certainly one of the actions that the bank took during the crisis, which was to expand a repo program into corporate bonds and paper, was very helpful in normalising that market at the time that that action was taken. You have demonstrated, the bank has demonstrated, that you are willing to take actions to continue to normalise. So should we be expecting that if we see continued volatility or activity in markets overseas in terms of bonds, that there'll be further bond activity in Australia?
Well, I just should clarify what it was we did with corporate bonds. So we said we would take a wider selection of corporate bonds of sufficient rating from banks that get liquidity from us as collateral. So we're not, unlike some other central banks, we're not holding those private sector bonds outright, but we are using them for collateral, and then a significant and appropriate haircut is applied to those. So that can provide a little bit more liquidity to those markets, because people know that banks will potentially desire them to hold as assets that they can come to us and get quick liquidity from if needed. But the bank hasn't considered the outright holdings of private sector assets. We are focused very much on our sovereign purchases, so that's of the Australian government securities and then the state and semi-authority securities.
So getting further into the inflation question, Chris, you know, we talked about productivity and innovation and encouraging those parts of the economy. I mean, that can dampen inflation as well. What's your views on, you know, trying to strike that balance in an environment where there is continued ongoing uncertainty? What are the types of things that you look to, again, as an advisor to the governor, to make sure that you're thinking about that interconnectivity between productivity and innovation and achieving the inflation target that you're after?
I think the thing you have to be careful here is more productivity growth by itself might suggest more competition and lower growth of prices, for example, and therefore less inflation. But I don't think that's the right way of thinking about it, because more productivity is more reward for both businesses and workers, and they can take those rewards in higher profits and higher wages. And that's the point about productivity supporting real incomes over the longer term. So I never would think about it in any sort of negative way. What it does is just sort of, you look at whatever productivity is doing or think you think it might do, and then that might give you, then you have to sort of make adjustments for whatever nominal wage and nominal profit growth is doing. But more productivity growth, you should see that in time in more wage growth. That's a good thing, because it's also more real wage growth.
The question about data and using data effectively to, you know, inform policy settings. Dr. Kennedy, the head of the Treasury Department, gave a speech talking about the importance of evidence-based policy, particularly through this period. The governor yesterday was also talking about the importance of data in decision-making. Is it time to have monthly inflation figures?
Well, I think we're in the public domain and sort of supporting efforts by the ABS to produce a monthly index for consumer price of consumer prices to help calculate inflation. And so that's something we'd be supportive of and would encourage the ABS when they have the resources to do that effectively. So we would be supporters of that.
Excellent. I think we would be supporters of it too, Chris. Just back to the responsible lending or lending standards question. I have been asked to ask you specifically, you know, just to be clear on your views here. Do you think that the difficulty in accessing finance is due to interpretation of the responsible lending obligations?
Well, that's what I was alluding to in my earlier answer. I mean, responsible lending obligations, that's very much a decision for the government, and it's in front of Parliament now. What we're focused on, though, is that there's two things. First, that lenders only really make the loans that they can reasonably expect to be repaid and not place borrowers under undue financial stress. And that borrowers need to have, you know, at the same time, sufficient access to suitable credit. So there's a balance to be struck there. And the challenge always is getting that balance exactly right. Having said all of that, you know, there is increasing growth in lending to owner-occupiers, not so much to investors. And lending, as I suggested, to business remains weak. So our sort of concern is to, we would like to sort of see a lift in that lending in time, including to businesses, because that will be consistent with businesses feeling like doing more investment, more innovation, and that would be a good thing to see. But, you know, APRA's prudential standards provide very similar protections to responsible lending obligations, making sure that banks lend responsibly.
Chris, a question about the GFC, and you can answer this as a personal or professional question. What were the lessons of the GFC that have been brought into this latest crisis, and what do you think the next crisis is going to require from us because of the lessons we've learned from this one?
Well, I won't speculate about the next crisis or problem. I mean, the Deputy Governor gave a fairly extensive and interesting look on his experiences. He was very much at the coalface during the GFC in the bank. My observation from that relates, I think, partly to what I already spoke about. Central banks have recognised that they've got their policy rates at the effective lower bound. And therefore, an important thing is probably to provide forward guidance, which we're doing, to be very clear about that. I think we have been. We're saying we're not going to increase the cash rate until we see inflation sustainably in that 2-3% range. And that's a very important way that central banks can support the economy and ultimately generate more wage growth and more inflation. So we've been very clear about that, and I think that's one of the lessons that was learned by central banks that ran up first against the effective lower bound en masse, not us, but many others at the time of the GFC.
So I think some unfair commentary about all of, you know, the whole circumstance of this crisis has been that it was a black swan event and there wasn't a lot of preparation. For my sins, Chris, I too have a background of having lived through the GFC on different sides of the table in terms of government regulators and industry and know the amount of preparation that's been done to make sure that we keep the system going. Whether that was pandemic related, and in fact there were specific plans about pandemic preparedness, but more generally dealing with crisis. Do you think that this was a black swan event, or do you think that, you know, humans have had the capacity to be able to face into this and there was actually some pretty good plans in place ready to deal with things? And I might put a few words in your mouth. I mean, the fact that there were announcements made in March and that the industry was coming together in January of last year, talking about and being prepared for what would happen to the system, I think says that we were prepared for this, even if it wasn't, you know, COVID-19 as the actual acronym for what we were dealing with. But in your sense, what do you think it was black swan, or do you think that there was a lot more preparation?
Well, one hopes it's a fairly rare thing, but I think the point I would focus on, rather than defining it was a black swan or not, and I think in many people's book it would be, but the more important thing would be, can you still hear me? It's telling me I might have connection issues. Okay, I'll just keep talking through that warning.
Keep talking. You're good. I'll let you know if you go silent.
So look, the point I was going to make is I think when we weren't unique in this, but one of a few countries that really demonstrated considerable flexibility and speed in dealing with all sorts of elements of what was really first and foremost a health crisis, but at risk of certainly a financial crisis and an economic crisis. And I think Australia did very well responding on all of those fronts by being quick to think about it, coming up with some quite innovative things, being fairly bold and trying some new things. And, course, it's been a terrible year, including for businesses, but also many people who've lost their jobs and lost incomes. But all in all, I would say that the thing that we had was a very responsive, not just policymakers in the public sector, and not just at the federal or the state level, but also in the private sector. Australians, I think, showed, great fortitude, but also a willingness to be very flexible and innovative in finding solutions to the difficulties and just getting on with things. And we're seeing the effects of that with the economy bouncing back faster than most, including us, expected.
And look, Chris, I think, what the Reserve Bank has demonstrated is that you have changed tact in terms of, leaning into asset bubbles and dealing with the crisis in terms of what was required now and taking lessons from the past. So my last question for you, because we're going to run out of time, but it is a question that's come through from a member. In 30 seconds or less, Chris, what keeps you up at night?
Not a lot. Yeah, I usually have a busy, tiring day. Have a good rest most evenings.
All right, I'll let you get away with that. You've been very generous with your thoughts, so thank you very much, Chris. We've covered a lot of ground, inflation targets and monetary policy and asset bubbles, I think, are going to continue to be on the minds of many of us throughout this year. But back to the core of what you were talking about, which was SMEs and support for SME finance and the importance of ensuring that that continues. I mean, the banks certainly have demonstrated that they're the shock absorbers of the crisis, and all lenders will be the pistons of recovery. So I think AFIA members are very keen to make sure they continue to be part of that support for the SME market. So thank you for your time today, Chris. Really appreciate it. There is a poll that's just popped up on the screen for our participants to please fill out. We're very interested in your thoughts. Just a reminder as well that we do have our DDO masterclass on the 30th of March, so please register for that. We know that a number of members have been keen to continue the conversation around the design and distribution obligations, which come into effect on the 5th of October this year, and we are being told very clearly from the regulator, ASIC, that we need to be compliant, so that'll be an important session for our members. So look, thank you very much again for your time today, Chris. A lot of good, strong messages there for us, but also the takeout from me is that we do need to continue to, work together to make sure that we're using our markets and using SMEs as part of the recovery in Australia. It's going to continue to be important. While we might want to point the finger at the large companies to pull their weight as well, we certainly know that the size of the SME market in Australia is considerable, and they are a big part of our recovery. So, look, thanks, everyone. I hope you have a good day, Chris. And everybody else, enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.